Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. And we take your phone calls during this hour so you can call in with questions about the Bible or the Christian faith or discuss matters where you have a disagreement with the host. You might be not a Christian at all and disagree with Christianity, or you might be a Christian who disagrees with the host anyway on any number of things. Certainly there are plenty of things that Christians don't all agree upon, and perhaps a larger number of things than the average, where many Christians would not agree with the host of this program. Not that there's any attempt here to be different or to be controversial. It's just that there are views popular in the modern church that are not the same as those which are sometimes come across when I answer people's questions here. And so you're welcome to call to balance comment if you'd like to. Except right now, if you're not already on the line, you won't be able to get through right now. Our lines are full. This will change, of course, through the program, and you may want to have this number ready. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Again, if you call now, you'll probably get a busy signal, but later in the program, there will be lines opening up. You can try randomly to catch an open line, and there will be some. An announcement I've been making this week, and don't have many more opportunities to make, but I need to, is that this Saturday in Southern California, and that would be largely related to people listening to us on the one station in the LA area that carries us, but that reaches all over Southern California, K-Bright. And I want you to know we have a monthly gathering in Southern California, two, actually. One is a men's Bible study on a Saturday morning, the third Saturday of the month, and that's in Temecula. That's coming up this Saturday. And the other is in Buena Park, which is in Orange County, California. And that's an evening meeting. And each month we're taking a different book of the Bible and moving through the Bible with a complete introduction and overview of the book this month, and that would be day after tomorrow. We're going through 1 Corinthians. That's Saturday evening. And then next week I'll be speaking in a variety of places in Oregon, and you're welcome, if you are an Oregon listener, to come to any of those meetings that may be near enough to you and that you may be available to attend. If you want specifics about the time and place of any of these meetings, whether the ones in Southern California or the ones in Oregon, all can be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, under the tab that says Announcements and under the proper dates. You can find anything you need to know. Okay, we've got our lines full, so let's talk to Paul from upstate New York, our first caller today. Paul, welcome.
Yes, Steve, thank you. So my question is, why did God command the Israelites to divorce their foreign wives in Ezra when they had always intermarried with other people like Ruth and Rahab and even the mixed multitude coming from Egypt?
Yeah, there was no general law of Moses that forbade Israelites to marry Gentiles, except Canaanites. I mean, they were not allowed to marry Canaanites, but... But they were not supposed to, they were supposed to be loyal to God and raise their children as believers in God. So obviously, the assumption would be that they would marry within the same faith. They might not, but it's sort of like Christians don't always marry within the faith, but they're supposed to. Because a Christian is not just an individual, but if he gets married and has children, he's raising a Christian family, hopefully. That's not always the case, but that's what God has in mind. The same thing was true with the Jewish people. That's why, of course, they had to circumcise their males in infancy. Now, that's assuming that their children are going to be part of this covenant family, too. That works out best if the father and mother are both part of the same religious system. Now, these people that had been married, that were marrying the locals in Ezra, might well be marrying people who had Canaanite stock. They were Samaritan people from the region. Now, there were still Canaanites around. And so there, it may well be that some of these were actually Canaanite people who Jews were forbidden to marry. But even if they were not, even if they're simply a people of a different religion than Judaism, this would be, I think Ezra felt, this would be more dangerous to them at this stage in their history than maybe at any other, because they had gone into captivity in Babylon because of their compromises with pagan religions. That's the very thing that had caused them to spend 70 years as captives, from which they had just returned. I mean, they had just come back from that. After 70 years, they should have learned their lesson, and they should have learned to be have zero compromise with pagan religions. But by marrying these women, it's clear that these women were not converts to Judaism like Rahab and Ruth were. These women, in some cases, the children didn't even know the language of the Jews anymore. I mean, they weren't being raised in Jewish culture and religion, which was something that was, I mean, Ezra believed, I think very reasonably, that this would mean it would bode ill for the next generation. And if they're adopting pagan practices because of compromise in their marriages, this is going to prevent the next generation of Jewish kids from being purely worshipers of God and make them tolerant of paganism, something that Ezra felt no Jew has any luxury of being tolerant about. So he did command them to break up those marriages. Now, we aren't told that God told them to. Ezra was not a prophet of God receiving revelations telling him to do this. This was his instinct. This was his temperament. This was his concern. And since divorce was never forbidden in the Old Testament, but in fact it was permitted if a man found some uncleanness in the woman he had married, I think Ezra felt like the fact that these women were definitely pagans would be some uncleanness worthy of divorce. And therefore, in order to keep the purity of the community, I believe that, and of the next generation, I think Ezra just said, hey, we can't tolerate this kind of intermixing of pagans and Jews. So he made them take a divide.
Okay, so it didn't have to do with keeping Israel a pure race, as I think the ESV translates it as a foreign race or something like that.
God was never too much concerned about the purity of the race. He was concerned with the purity of their religion. When God told them not to marry the Canaanites, it wasn't because these people did not have Jewish blood and would pervert the race of Jews. It was, God always said, because you'll learn to follow their gods. In other words, their religion is so contrary to yours. You don't want to mix religions in your home. And the fact that someone like Rahab, who was a Canaanite but converted to Judaism, and Ruth, who also was a Moabite and converted to Judaism, that they, without any controversy, married within the Jewish community, and both of them even became ancestors of David and of Jesus, ultimately. The fact that that was not controversial is because they were of the same faith. They mixed the race as much as a Canaanite would. The Moabites and Canaanites are not Jewish, so there was racial mixing going on, and David himself came from such racial mixing. But God was never a racist. God never really was concerned about the purity of the race, but the purity of the hearts. He never cared about the circumcision of the flesh, but the circumcision of the heart. His concern about intermarriage with pagans was that pagans were pagans, not that they weren't Hebrews, but they weren't Jewish by religion. And therefore, God actually never did forbid interracial marriage in principle. Like I said, only the Canaanites, he told them not to marry them. But Canaanites were a very small percentage of the Gentiles around Israel. But his concern was always that there be no religious corruption, and that was the concern with Ezra, too.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Paul, thanks for your call. Asa from Linwood, Washington, good to hear from you again. I remember meeting you.
Hi, good to hear you again, Steve. I'll get right to the point. Your answer a couple of days ago to a suicide question, it made me ponder how the Calvinists might defend God's sovereignty as it relates to those predestined to election, because does God rescue only all those he bought with a price from suicide, his sovereignty countermanding the effects of free will, or are they still elect despite this act? Three, does this act prove that they weren't elect? any more than Judas, although, you know,
well, you won't get,
apparently wasn't.
Yeah, you won't get exactly the same answer from any two people, you know, even of the same theological camp on certain issues. Calvinism, pure Calvinism, teaches that if you are one of the elect, then you will not die without having been converted, without having become a Christian. Having, you know, the fact that you do become converted and remain converted till death is the evidence in their mind that you have been elected. Now, if you die before you're converted, then it only shows that, you know, that didn't happen. You weren't elected, because God's sovereignty would have guaranteed that you would have become a believer before your death. And that's why some Calvinists, now some balk at this, but really strict Calvinists that I've known have often said that a baby who dies, even in the womb, simply shows it's not elect. Why? Because if it was elect, it would have, God would have sovereignly kept it alive until it became a believer. And the fact that someone dies before that happens, whether they're 100 years old or, you know, a fetus in the womb, doesn't matter what their age is. If they die without having been converted, it's simply the proof they weren't elect. Now, many Calvinists on the baby issue would take that differently. They would, some Calvinists I know would say, well, God knows if it was elect or not. And if it was elect and it died, then it goes to heaven. If it was not elect, it goes to hell. But still, Calvinists, either way, they have some babies go to hell, which is, to my mind, absurd biblically and abhorrent. But as far as a person committing suicide, I think, and you know, if a person committed suicide and therefore died without Christ, then I think to say, well, that's proof that they're not elect, the same as if they died in an accident or were murdered by a home invasion or died in war or anything, or sickness. You know, I mean, if people die, no matter how they die, if they die before they're converted, they were not elect. Now, there may be Calvinists who would say a person committing suicide isn't always giving proof that they're not elect. They might say, well, you know, some people who commit suicide are mentally ill, or they're distraught, or they're, you know, I'm not sure. This is something not only a Calvinist, but any human being might argue.
Right.
That, you know, a person who commits suicide may not be in their right mind, and therefore may not be doing something for which they are fully responsible. And as Christians, even real Christians, sometimes succumb to temptations, without proving that they are, you know, not Christians, there might be some Calvinists that would say, well, the fact that someone committed suicide, that's a sin. They succumbed to a temptation, but it doesn't necessarily mean they weren't believers. But on the other hand, if a person commits suicide and wasn't a believer, obviously they would be argued not to have been elect.
Yeah, because there are some stark statements in Christendom as it relates to how it's found in the Bible. For instance, in 1 John 3:15, it states that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him.
Right.
And
right.
Obviously, there is no chiefer murder than that of your own self. Well, it starts
well, many
with
people,
anyway.
Yeah, many people think that self-murder would be in a more permissible category, because they would say, well, you know, I can't kill you because that's interfering in your life, but if I kill me, that's just interfering in my life. And, you know, it's my life. I can do what I want with it. And, of course, people who think like that are not Christians, because a Christian knows that we don't belong to ourselves. We've been bought with a price. We're not our own. Right. So, but there are people who are maybe think themselves Christians and don't understand what it means to be a Christian, and who might make that fallacious argument that, well, you know, I can do what I want with my life. It's a very sad thing. But, you know, here's an important thing.
Yeah.
We wonder about people who commit suicide, partly because we have loved ones that we know who have committed suicide, or at least our friends have loved ones that commit suicide. We certainly don't. All of us know somebody whose family has been impacted by suicide, and it's a horrible thing that they go through as a result of that happening in their family. And so, you know, we'd like to be able to give consolation. Well, this person could be saved or whatever. We don't want to just tell them this person's in hell, because we don't know for sure if that's the case, but it kind of looks that way, but we might be wrong. But the interesting thing is that the Bible doesn't even address it. It's not like the Bible doesn't know about suicide. King Saul committed suicide. Judas committed suicide. Ahithophel committed suicide in the Bible. But there's nothing said in the Bible about, could anyone who commits suicide actually have been, a believer or been saved? The Bible doesn't give that kind of information because it's not trying to tell us how to judge other people's state. The Bible teaches us how we are to live. We might hope in the mercy of God for somebody that we know who commits suicide, who, perhaps they were a very, godly and good person almost right up until the moment they did that. And then they shocked everyone and did something quite out of character for themselves. And we might say, well, God must know that they had a brain tick or something, something happened to that they weren't themselves and they did something they can't really be held responsible for. Well, maybe if that's true, then we can hope in the mercy of God. We just can't give any assurance because the Bible doesn't. What we do know, and we don't have to have all the answers to, is this person who died saved? Is this person who died saved? People always want to know that kind of stuff about others.
Yeah.
But that's not a need-to-know thing. God lets us know things on a need-to-know basis. And what we need to know is we better not do that. God is displeased with that. Committing suicide is not okay.
Yeah.
And that's about the most we can say with certainty about people who do commit suicide. It's not really okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks, brother, for the, I would consider a satisfactory answer on that.
Well, thank you, and God bless you. It's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you as well, Steve. Have a blessed day.
You too. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Chris from Spokane, Washington. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I just want to first say thank you for your service to the kingdom of God and for teaching all of your listeners about the Bible. I truly appreciate that. So I'll get straight to my question with a brief intro. Okay. Mm-hmm. A sense of humor is a trait that most people want to be thought of as lacking. I enjoy experiencing humor in my personal relationships, and I often witness humor while observing nature. I feel that some Christians, however, marginalize humor or have difficulty approving of humor in their life while simultaneously maintaining the reverence for God. I sense that some Christians think that they must be mutually exclusive things, with humor having little value due to its selfish nature. Do you believe that it's beneficial to nurture humor in one's life within appropriate boundaries? And is a sense of humor worthy, a worthy intellectual pursuit, or just an unnecessary additive in the life of a Christian? And also, have you ever found any biblical examples that you personally interpret as God's sense of humor?
Well, it depends on what we call humor. We find humor in different things. A lot of humor is in the form of what we call irony or sarcasm, and there's a lot of that. Jesus uses irony and sarcasm. So did God and the prophets. And, sarcasm is actually a rhetorical device, but it also is the basis of much of what we call humor. I mean, if you listen to a stand-up comedian, in many cases, what makes you laugh is the sarcastic remarks they make. Also, jokes sometimes are funny simply because they are so true. I mean, many times when you're listening to a comic or something and they say something, or when you're watching a sitcom and something happens that makes you laugh, a lot of times you just feel like saying, that is so true. I mean, that is so how it is, And it almost makes you laugh to contemplate that it's that way. In other words, there's nothing dark about humor in itself. There's a lot of humor. I mean, don't people laugh when they watch kittens play on the floor and tumble around and, fall off of things and stuff? I mean, when you watch little animals, when you watch babies or little children, it tickles you. I mean, frankly, there's tons of YouTube videos of little babies just that make you laugh because they're so cute. I mean, let's face it, laughter is a positive response to things that for one reason or another strike you as amusing. Obviously, a lot of humor is coarse. A lot of it is at another person's expense, so it's unkind. A lot of humor is, a lot of comedians I've heard, and I don't listen to many of them because I don't find them funny, it seems like they don't have any content to their humor except bad words. I mean, they count on the use of foul language to shock and alarm and get their audience to laugh. Of course, more and more, that's not going to work because those words are used in ordinary speech so often it doesn't shock anyone anymore. But there was a season there where if I ever listened to a comedian, it was often the case that there was not at all anything witty or funny in what they said. It's just their shocking use of a word that is, you know, uncouth, that would make people laugh, maybe nervously. But so, I mean, humor exists. There are things that are amusing and should be amusing. God is amused by certain things. He makes fun of certain things. He makes fun of idolaters who go out and get a tree and they use part of it to warm themselves and bake their bread in the oven, and they use part of it to carve into an image and worship it as a god. I mean, God points that out as if, you know, how absurd is this? You know, it is absurd. It's amusing almost, although if it wasn't so offensive. But the point is, humor is not just one thing. Now, humans might be the only creatures God made that can appreciate humor. And by appreciate humor, I mean have a sense of humor. Sense means you become aware of something. If you have a sense of hot and cold, then you know when it's too hot in a room or when it's too cold in a room. If you didn't have that sense, it would still be either too hot or too cold, but you just wouldn't know it. Wouldn't have any sense of it. Likewise, there are things that are funny and amusing, or should be, which some people don't pick up on it. They don't have a sense of humor. But to sense that that's amusing is not wrong. To have a sense of humor and to laugh, I mean, I think God gave humans the ability to recognize humor and enjoy it and to laugh. I think it's therapeutic, for one thing. And but what he doesn't want us to do is to give our whole lives over to levity. In other words, to get, you know, to be so amused by things that we never think seriously about anything. And there are people who do that. They want to make a joke about everything. But even the most somber people and the holiest people I know often will make a wry joke or will laugh at something that they hear that's funny, and legitimately, I think. I mean, even God sits in the heavens and laughs, the Bible says in Psalm 2. And what's he laughing at? He's laughing at all these tin horn rulers and little bugs, human bugs, on a planet who are shaking their fist at him saying, we'll get you, God. We'll throw off your chains from us. And it says God sits in the heavens and laughs. You know, that's funny. That's humorous. It is. It is humorous. But he doesn't laugh all day. It says then he speaks to them in anger. You know, it's something will strike you as funny. And if it is funny, there's no reason you shouldn't laugh and find it humorous. On the other hand, once you've stopped laughing or once the initial humor of the situation wears off, sometimes you need to take a serious approach to the subject. You know, if a married couple don't have any sense of humor, they will probably have a rather unpleasant life together. I mean, if you can see humor in things together, laughing together, especially in watching the children and so forth, if you can't take delight and amusement in things together, then you're not really as human as I think you should be. And remember, humans are the ones who are made in the image of God, which may be why we are the species that recognizes humor. That means has a sense of the humorous, a sense of humor. Now, sometimes chimpanzees and dolphins and things like that, very smart creatures, sometimes they'll laugh, seemingly, but we don't know what they're thinking. We don't know if just the way they talk or the way that they relate in some other way sounds like laughter to us. We don't know what's going on in their heads. We don't know for sure that any animal has what we call a sense of humor, like humans do. But it's a rare thing for a human not to. And I think the human who doesn't have a sense of humor is one who's been broken in some ways. That sense of humor has been tamped down or even trodden down by choosing a negative attitude about the world and sometimes very much provoked by real life. Real life can certainly take the humor out of your life if you if you lose your children or if you lose a spouse or if you lose everything, if you're a homeless person on the street. And I mean, I can see someone having such tragedy in their life that they find very little humorous anymore. But that's not the natural state. That's not the healthy state. You know, I think that we should be more resilient. And even when we find things that make us grieve and cry, we have to realize that, you know, this is a passing thing and there still are things that are both joyful and humorous. So I personally, I've never had the impression that being a holy or pious person is somehow contrasted from having a sense of humor. Sometimes I've learned the most from preachers who were humorous, and not because they were cracking jokes. Usually a preacher who cracks jokes doesn't impress me much. But a lot of times just the offhand statements they make or the observations they make sometimes make me laugh because I said they're so true. And it's an enjoyable way to learn things that are true. Anyway, that's a brief treatment of a broad subject. I hope that's helpful to you. We need to take a break. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We have another half hour coming up. The Narrow Path is listener supported. If you'd like to help us out, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
If you enjoy the Narrow Path radio program, you'd really like the resources at our website, thenarrowpath.com, where hundreds of biblical lectures and messages by our host, Steve Gregg, can be accessed without charge and listened to at your convenience. If you have not done so, visit the website, thenarrowpath.com, and discover all that is available for your learning pleasure.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you'd like to join us, the number to call is 844-484-5737. Our next caller in line is Ace from Portland, or Sonoma Coast, California. I'm sorry, I was thinking of someone from Portland. Ace from Sonoma Coast, California. Ace, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. There's always about a dozen things that I would like to talk to you about, and I'm always at a loss for which one to choose. So I put them all in little pieces of paper in a hat, and I just pulled one out. But I'd just like to remind your listeners that have problems with atheists calling into your show that or agnostics like myself we subsidize you in some part with by giving you a tax-free existence, basically. So it's good to remember that.
I don't have a tax-free existence. I have to pay taxes like everybody else.
The church in general does not pay taxes. So if you're not tapping into that somehow, then that's your loss. But in large part, any church that you see located in any community is not paying taxes.
But all the members of that church are paying taxes, are the leaders.
That's immaterial. We're still, as a homeowner, I'm still subsidizing the space for them to exist. But whatever the case, what I really wanted to talk to you about today was, it kind of relates to that, I suppose, with two things that I wanted to talk to you about. First is, are you familiar? I'm sure you're familiar with the term e pluribus unum.
Yes. Out of many one.
And can you translate that for your listeners?
Out of many one?
Yes, and that was the motto of the country as established by our founders.
It was
and
one
it's
of
a
them.
Beautiful yes, concept because it means that no matter what your opinion is, you belong to this country. But then what happened to E Pluribus Unum? It got replaced by One Nation Under God, which... Basically,
how is that a replacement?
That's the national motto now.
It's not. It's
we're
a line
known as One Nation Under God.
Excuse me. It's a line in the flag salute. The flag salute is not the national motto. some lady wrote the flag salute.
Maybe I'm thinking of In God We Trust.
That's on the coins. Uh-huh. But that's still,
That's what replaced E Pluribus Unum. I'm sorry, I got those two mixed up. But whatever the case, I don't trust in any God. I think that it's all imaginary. It's just a figment of your imagination. And whenever
I know you think that.
I listen to you talk to people. Anyway, the other thing I was going to mention is that, and this is a totally serious question. I heard you talking about how Bible or God or whatever you want to give credit to made man and woman. Uh-huh. And this is a serious question. So, does the Bible say anything about why men have nipples?
No, it doesn't have a word about that.
Do you know why men have nipples?
I don't. I'm not really sure why men have an appendix either.
When the fetus is developing in the womb, the nipples actually develop before the rest of the sexual organs develop. And there's a chemical change in the way the body is developing that kind of leads to being a female or leads to being a male. And so my point is that the problem that I have with the Bible is that there's no ambiguity to it. It's all right or wrong, devil or God, broken or fixed. And
I think maybe you ought to read the Bible before you say things like that. Totally different than what the Bible is like.
You can always pick out examples to counter my claims. And that's
like the example of the whole Bible itself. It's not that unambiguous. There's lots of ambiguity.
Okay, well, the fact is, humans, male and have you ever known a masculine female?
Of course.
Uh huh. And how about a feminine male?
Yes.
Yeah, so we know that when it comes to sexuality, it's different from gender. And whatever your sexual organs are, don't define what you are inside. And what you are inside you shouldn't be told that you're broken because the way you feel inside is different from the way you're represented with your sexual organs.
Okay, well, let me jump in here. What you feel inside may have nothing to do with what you are objectively in reality. When you say that gender and sex are not the same thing, that is simply taking the word gender and giving it a definition that means what somebody acts like, because we were talking about a man who acts femininely or a woman who acts masculinely, or how they feel about themselves, okay? So, in other words, you're using the word gender as merely a psychological state. Okay, well, psychological states, there's a wide variety of psychological states. Not all of them have to do with gender, but sure, there are people who have all kinds of things, delusions, frankly. Some people think they're Napoleon. Some people think they're a cat, and some women have done facial surgery to look as much like a cat as possible and simply ruin themselves because they identify as a cat. The fact that somebody in their psychological state identifies as something that's different than reality does not mean that we now put a stamp of approval on their delusion, say that's their genuine gender. People can use the word gender that way, if they want to, but that doesn't make it so. That just means that we've given a certain name to their delusion. There's always been, the psychiatric journals have always had names for people's delusions, including that one. Gender dysphoria has been in the psychological literature for hundreds of years and always recognized as a delusional or at least a mentally not well condition. All that has happened in modern times is to take what no doubt has always happened, that is people sometimes think about themselves differently than they are, and instead of saying, we ought to help them adjust their thinking to reality so they can live in the real world according to the realities that the world has dealt them, as most people have to do. Or we can say, let's just affirm their delusions and chop their bodies up and do all kinds of things that are permanently destructive to them. And tell them we're affirming their gender. Well, what we're calling their gender is their delusion. You don't affirm delusions if you love people. If you love people, you try to help them adjust to what reality is. Now, sexual identity, I don't care how early it develops in the zygote or in the fetus. The truth is that the DNA in the zygote has male or female characteristics already. That's what makes it a human being. It has DNA. It has chromosomes that are either determining it to grow to a male or female. Now, if certain parts of the structure of the body develop earlier than others, that's of no consequence in determining what they are. It's because what they're developing into is determined from the moment of conception by their DNA and by their chromosomes. So, you know, we can point out things like that, but it doesn't really make a difference in terms of the question of how are we supposed to be compassionate and helpful to people who are confused about their gender. You see, I think Christians and non-Christians both want to find the way to be as compassionate as possible to people who are confused and miserable. In many cases, they are miserable. And, you know, one attitude is, okay, their mind and physical reality are not aligned. So let's try to chop up physical reality to line it with their demented mind. The other view is, well, why don't we do with them what we've always done with mentally ill people? Try to give them counseling, try to give them some way to adjust to reality. Because no matter how many body parts you chop off, you're never going to change the fact whether you have a Y chromosome or not in every cell of your body. You're going to be always whatever sex you were. And if you want to, you know, pretend to be another sex, well, our society allows you to pretend it, but it doesn't, you know, frankly, transsexual people have the highest suicide rate of virtually anyone in the population, which is not indicating that it's a happy state. I think people need
counsel.
Holy
smokes, Steve.
Yeah.
Steve, I brought up one issue, and you go on this long rant, and you present about 12 different ideas.
Okay, well, if you don't want to talk about, don't want me to talk about the issues that you raised, then fine. But I think I talked about the issue you raised. The issue raised is, and this is the point you said, was that gender and sex are different things. I believe that's the exact issue I was talking about the whole time I was talking to you. Feel free to call back with other issues other times. We've got a lot of people waiting, and I can't just accommodate you. But I will be glad to talk to you further. I do want to say this, though, because I think you have at least one delusion, and that is that atheists are subsidizing the church. You're not. Atheists don't pay anything to support the church. The only thing about the atheist pays taxes, and so does the Christian. Now, the church is one institution that doesn't have to pay taxes as an institution. That doesn't mean they take money from the government. Doesn't mean that you as a taxpayer are putting any of your money into the church. You pay for the government's programs. The church is not a government program. In fact, by definition, the church is not supposed to be supported by the government, and it isn't. But it also doesn't have to support the government. It is something independent. Now, on the other hand, I, as a Christian, have to support your public schools, which are teaching my children are now grown and never went to public school, but you know, Christian children are being taught atheism and anti-Christian dogma, and we Christians do have to pay for that. The taxes we are forced to pay for those public schools to corrupt our children. Now, you as an atheist paying taxes are not none of that money is going to support the church. So you're not subsidizing the church. I'm not sure how you think things work. And I think a lot of times when you call, it's obvious you're not very much aware of how things work in the world. And I think you need to get your facts straight. Because if you think that you're subsidizing Christianity, then I'd like to ask, when did one penny from your pocket ever come into the church? If you can trace one of them from your pocket into the church, I'd be interested in hearing about it. But I seriously doubt that you've subsidized Christianity in the slightest in any way, or that any atheist has, unless they used to be part of the church and used to give to it. John from Detroit, Michigan, welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
I would like you to address the issue of the calculations that astrophysicists and cosmologists and geologists and geophysicists make regarding the age of the Earth, the age of the cosmos. And I am this is brought to mind because of the recent improvements in telescopy and the telescopes that are said to be able to observe galaxies and stars that
are
billions of light years away.
All right. Well, you wanted to hear my take on it? The truth is that those sciences are pretty much above my pay grade. I don't have any expertise in them, nor do I have any investment in them. I couldn't care less how old the Earth is. If the Earth is billions of years old and in a universe that's tens of billions of years old, that's okay with me. I've got no problem with that. On the other hand, if the Earth is only thousands of years old, that's good too. I'm good with it. I mean, in others, how does that impact me? It doesn't impact me at all. Now, some people think that the Bible tells us how old the Earth and there is, and that it's in conflict with what these scientists are saying. Now, it is true that one way of looking at biblical statements certainly would give the impression that the Earth is only a few thousand years old instead of billions of years old. It's not the only way to look at the Bible. There are many, many Christians and Bible scholars who believe in the Bible, but they don't look at it through that lens of that I just mentioned, and they accept the fact, they accept as a fact, that the Earth is billions of years old. So the fact that knowledgeable Christians who believe every word in the Bible can believe that the Earth is thousands of years old or billions of years old makes it clear that the Bible does not unambiguously answer a question like that, nor does it concern itself with the question. And nor do I, as a follower of Jesus Christ, have anything to gain or lose by however that question is answered. I will say this, however, I do know something, though I'm not a scientist myself. I know what science is. Science, of course, makes observations. And then it tests those observations to see if they're, always the same and so forth. From a closed system of materialism, science has to sort of project backward, for example, when it comes to age of the Earth. They have to kind of look at processes that are going on now, the speed of light coming from stars far away, the decay of radioactive elements into lead or some other simpler element. And they look at these processes that are going on, erosion and such, and then they kind of postulate, based on those rates, how long those rates have been going on to bring about the results we see from some earlier, situation that they assume existed. Now, there's certain things we have to ask ourselves. Do we know that all things have been caused by these processes? Do we know that these processes have always taken place at the same rate they do now? We might assume it, but we don't know it. They might have. They might not have. I mean, that's simply not within the realm of testability. We cannot test, for example, whether the speed of light is slowing down over the billions of years. Some scientists have suggested it might be, but we don't know. I mean, it's somebody's guess. We don't know if uranium has decayed into lead at the same rate since it first came into existence, or if it's slowing down or speeding up. We just don't know that. We can't test that stuff. What scientists do is they look at the way things are now. They take for granted that that's how it's always been, and then they postulate from that to suggest dates of origins and things like that. Now, that's, I guess, a fair way to do things if you acknowledge the limitations of that process. That limitations are that you're assuming you know how things have gone before anyone was around testing them. And you might be right, but you might not. That's not a testable thing, which means it's not within the realm of science. You can't really know whether uranium always, had a half-life of 4.5 billion years. It might always have, but no one was here to test it, so we'll just have to, assume it. Well, we can do that if we want to, and then we can make some assumptions about other things based on that. On the other hand, if someone said, well, we don't know, and I'm not sure that that always was the same, and I have some other things to consider too, because in my worldview, there's also a God. There's also the possibility that things can happen that aren't caused by natural processes at natural rates and so forth. We, a Christian, can actually believe that if there's a God, there could be miracles. If there are miracles, then God might do things that are quite contrary to what we observe on a general basis. If that's true, then the scientists would be making guesses and calculations based on ignorance of those things. Now, of course, the person might say, the Christian, you can't prove there's a God. Well, I'm not saying we can. But no one has ever proved that there isn't one, nor is there any imaginable way to prove that there isn't one. And therefore, we have to say the existence of God as a factor or not is simply a starting assumption. You either start with the assumption there could be God and he could have done things supernaturally, or you start with the assumption there is no God and everything has to be explained in terms of natural processes going on today. Both are assumptions. It may turn out that an assumption being wrong leads to wrong conclusions, obviously. So, but I'm not arguing for either outcome. I believe there's a God, and I believe God created things. But whether he did it, 10,000 years ago or 10 billion years ago, it's not of the slightest interest to me. Both of those dates are a lot longer ago than I have ever had any dealings in the world or have any interest in them. I'm living in a real world that exists right now, and I have responsibilities and concerns that are today. They don't have anything to do with billions of years ago. I realize that people are very curious about things that don't matter, and I think that's among them, is how old is the Earth? How old is the universe? Well, I don't. It's not one of those things that matters to me. If it matters to you, well, then you might want to study it out and make your own decisions on it. I appreciate your call, though. Let's talk to Jeff from Raleigh, North Carolina. Jeff, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, brother. How you doing, bro? I really appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I was wondering, what was the comment about a couple of things?
Well, we don't have very much time. We have a full switchboard. Why don't you not comment about a lot of things? Why don't we get to one point that you have in mind?
Okay. All right. I'll do that. Okay. The first caller was talking about, marriage of the Jews and everything. And the atheist called in, and you got this guy with the earth
age
and
of
how
the
old he is and all this stuff. Yeah. And I think what I'm going to say is it'd help a lot. I don't know. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But prophecy, the good news of the Bible was when Jesus was born, it's fulfillment of prophecy from the very beginning of Genesis 3:15. And it had to come through the Jewish line or the Hebrew line. And they had to marry into their faith so everything to go right. And I think this is the reason why, God wanted them to marry in their faith. And it had nothing to do with bloodline, ethnic, anything that stuff like that. It had everything to do with faith, like Hebrews 11 talks about.
Right. I'm going to have to cut you off because that's exactly what I said. And it doesn't sound like you have a question. Sometimes people want to call and say, tell me what they know, but a lot of times I'd like people to either have a question or call to disagree. Doesn't sound like you disagree, does it?
Or a comment, right?
Well, if it's a disagreeable comment. I don't need everyone to comment on things we've already said because we got a lot of people waiting with actual questions. Do you have a question for me?
Yeah, do you hold to that? Do you believe that that's what really was what happened was why they had to marry in their faith is because so the Messiah will be born.
Sure. The concern God had for the purity of Israel had to do with them being the nation, the only nation in the world, actually, that knew about the real God. Every nation other than Israel in ancient times believed in many gods. They were polytheists. Israel was the only religion in ancient times that believed in one true God. And they were a small nation, and God did not want that knowledge to be lost. He made himself known to them so that they could make him known to the other nations. Of course, this ultimately didn't happen until Jesus came from Israel and sent his disciples, who were from Israel, out to the nations to evangelize them. But in the meantime, till Jesus came, God had to preserve a community who actually knew of him so they could eventually bring light to the Gentiles. All right, let's talk to Ron from Texas. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Yeah.
I got a couple of scriptures I'd like to give you, then a question. Hosea chapter 6, verse 2 and 3, and 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8.
Okay, so on the third day he will raise us up in Hosea and in Peter. It's a day to the Lord is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years like a day.
So the question is Jesus returning in the spring, 2,000 years after his resurrection in the spring?
Well, no. I mean, he can come anytime he wants to. I don't know how when he's going to come. The Bible makes it very clear. We don't know the day or the hour. In fact, Jesus made it clear to his disciples in Acts 1:7, that's not even for them to be curious about, or us. Why should I care about when Jesus is coming back? What would that change in my life? Absolutely nothing, because I believe all Christians are obliged to live every day as if it was the last, because it might be for them. Even if Jesus doesn't come back for 1,000 years, you could die today, in which case it's all the same as if he came back, as far as you're concerned. So, I mean, anyone who's obsessed with deciding, I think I know when Jesus is coming back. First of all, everyone who's done that has been wrong. Everyone. And that's not just a few people. Hundreds of people, if not thousands throughout history, have set dates for the second coming of Christ. Every one of them has been wrong. So, I mean, if you're going to say you think you have a way of calculating when Jesus is going to come back, those two scriptures do not do the job, I don't think. I don't think either of them is talking about the second coming of Christ. Well, maybe the second one alludes to it, but it's not really giving us a time for it. So I'm just thinking, why? Why bother setting such dates when Jesus said it's not even in the domain that belongs to us to know the times and the seasons? If God doesn't want us to know them, why do I want to go against him and try to figure out what the times and seasons are? Why not just occupy, like he said, until he comes? If we occupy, we might get something done. If we spend our time calculating dates for the second coming, two things will happen. One is we won't get much else done. And two, we'll end up being wrong and probably embarrassing the world, being like the boy that cried wolf. Oh, again, the wolf didn't show up. Okay, let's see here. Carol from Berkeley, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, you're welcome. I have been looking for a church, and I came across the lady yesterday that handed me some material about their church. And when I got home and read it, it said it was a Bethel Baptist church. And I want to know your opinion of the Bethel church.
Okay. Well, Bethel Church is not the same as Bethel Baptist. Bethel Church in Redding, California, is kind of a center for the New Apostolic Reformation movement, which I think has some alarming characteristics. I would not recommend it. On the other hand, Bethel Baptist it's not even a denomination. There's 40 or so different denominations of Baptists, but Bethel Baptist is not a denomination. It's just a word that some people attach to their church, like Calvary Baptist or Bethel Baptist or some other word. There's so many Baptist churches, people like to put a more personalized name to their church to distinguish it from others. Baptist churches can be fine. I was raised in a Baptist church. I'm not a Baptist now, but I have, of course, most of what I believed as a Baptist probably is still with me. I don't recommend any particular denomination, and I believe any church, Baptist or otherwise, can be a good church if the pastor and the leaders and the people in it are good, loving Christian people. That's the mark of a good church, is love and, of course, faithfulness to God and his word. You may very well find that a church called Bethel Baptist meets those qualifications, and it may be a great church. You'd have to go and find out. There's nothing about the name of a church like that that would tell you in advance whether you're going to find a good group or a bad group there. But if you met somebody from there and they were nice, I would at least check it out. It might be a good home for you. Thank you for your call. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Everything there is free. You can donate there if you want, but it's free at thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.